Hi everyone, welcome to the fourth episode of Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, where we explore the neuroscience behind the emotions we're all experiencing in this pandemic. I'm Gaia.
And I'm Emily. Hi everyone. Before we get going, I have a small announcement to make.
Ooh, what is it?
Okay, I'm really proud of this. We now have over 1,000 listens. Can you believe it?
Oh my goodness, over 1,000. Thank you all so much, our listeners, for your support.
Thank you so much for tuning in. It means so much to us. We hope this series has been in some small ways informative or reassuring. We hope that it had helped you make maybe just a little bit more sense of this crazy unprecedented time of COVID-19.
Also, we now have our very own Facebook page. So if you want to stay in touch, you know, when we research for our episodes, we read so much more interesting stuff that we're not able to fit into an episode. So we'll be posting some of these things on our page.
It's also going to be a place where you can post your thoughts, suggestions, or questions. It'll be super fun.
Woo!
Our handle is NeuroJunkies, one word. I'll put the spelling in our show notes. Okay. So today we're switching gears to look at the positive side, the silver lining in this pandemic, altruism. We wanted to understand why we act to help others, sometimes even at the cost to ourselves. We would talk about what is driving so many of us to help, especially in a stressful time like this pandemic.
With that, let's get started. This is Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, the altruistic brain.
I've been looking forward to doing this episode for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've been all doom and gloom for the first few episodes. But actually, this episode has been on our minds since we first decided to do this series.
I still remember how in the initial outbreak in New York in March, how healthcare workers were flying in from everywhere in the country to help.
Phew, that feels so long ago.
I know. Yeah, it still gives me goosebumps thinking about it. So I saw that Southwest Air Crew took a picture of a plane full of these volunteers and posted it on their social media. And they wrote that these brave souls soldier on in the midst of tremendous risk and exposure, constantly putting the needs of others above their own. Their selfless sacrifice is a beacon of light during such a dark time in our world, and no amount of gratitude and praise would ever be enough.
That is, wow, so true. And apart from frontline workers and volunteers, I feel that people are actually going out of their way more and more to care for each other in this difficult time. People, you know, were putting together monetary donations and sending food, handmade masks, face shields to the front line.
Right. And it is not easy to keep businesses closed, socially distanced from friends and family, and wear a mask when going outside. Yet we still do it for each other and for the more vulnerable members of our community. And that's really, really powerful.
It really is. And I find it to be one of the, you know, most fascinating and beautiful aspects of our minds. I kept wondering, what has led us, so many of us, to put the safety and well-being of others before ourselves sometime? Because really, what we're talking about here is altruism, which is to put others' needs first and do something for others in spite of the inconvenience for yourself. But not just in this pandemic, right? But also in general day-to-day life. Why are we altruistic?
And that is what we're exploring in this episode today. We want to talk about the evolution of altruism. Yeah, animals also help each other, and evolution didn't make us all selfish, contrary to common belief.
Then we'll talk about the history and physiology of altruism.
We also want to explore the intersection of stress and altruism. Like, why do we still help others in highly stressful situations like this pandemic, even when our own safety is at risk? And lastly, we want to explore the us versus others mentality because our altruism may not be universal.
I can't wait.
So, I am really curious to hear what you have for the evolution of altruism, Gaia, because I'm not sure it is evolutionary.
Oh, what do you mean?
So, as I understand, altruism is a moral practice to put the happiness of others before that of yourself. It is so central to a lot of philosophical or religious thought to sacrifice some aspect of our own existence or happiness for the benefit of others.
Mm-hmm.
But evolution is supposed to be somewhat selfish, right? To compete and promote your own survival. So I just find it hard to believe animals would have evolved to be virtuous or altruistic.
Yeah, fair. These are really good points, Em. And actually, the paradox of altruism has stymied scientists for a really long time. In fact, Darwin wrote in The Descent of Man, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, he who was ready to sacrifice his life rather than betray his comrades would often leave no offspring to inherit his noble nature.
Oh my God, ouch. That's a bit harsh. But I mean, that's the crux of the paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, well, look, I'm not going to tell you what to believe, but allow me to give you a few examples from the animal kingdom, and then you can tell me if you're convinced, okay?
Okay.
So altruism is actually a key area of study in biology and behavior, but biologists don't really use language such as virtuous or moral, because we cannot really know that in animals. Biologists define altruism as when the behavior of individual A increases the survival fitness of individual B, while decreasing its own survival fitness.
Okay, I guess that's fair. I love when we can start on a really, really concrete definition. Let's hear some animal altruism stories.
Okay, all right. Well, my first example is going to be one of biology's classic examples of altruism, vampire bats. The altruism of vampire bats involves the sacrificing of resources, in their case, food, to help other vampire bats. Now, a vampire bat can only survive about 2 days without food, but sometimes they won't be able to find food for days on end. In such cases, the vampire bat that couldn't find food will often beg another bat for food. The donor bat then donates some of the meal that it hunted and found. Now, this has been really well documented, and what's really interesting about this is that it's been observed that donor bats actually go around offering to share their food rather than, you know, being harassed by their hungry brethren.
That sounds pretty generous of the donor bat. They spend all this time and energy getting the blood meal only to then share it with their starving friends.
Yep.
But I mean, it might be a smart idea that increases the survival if they're just occasionally sharing their food and possibly getting reciprocated when they are the ones starving one day.
Aha, that's very well spotted and a very good point. Well, here's another one. If we're talking about really putting your life at risk, ants and bees are good examples of making the ultimate sacrifice. Insects that live in colonies regularly sacrifice themselves for their colonies.
Huh, what do they do?
Okay, let me take the example of honeybees. They have these stingers attached to their abdomen, and they often have to sting to protect their hive. And when they do so, the stinger gets jabbed into the skin of the attacking animal and can't be easily removed. When the bee then tries to leave the victim, it rips off the bee's abdomen, causing it to die.
Ouch.
Yep. And actually, it's similar for carpenter ants, because when these ants are facing danger or when their colony is facing danger, these ants explode, releasing these chemicals that adhere to the enemies of these ants and thus protect the colony.
Holy moly! Insects are just so fascinating. Although that's also a very, very special kind of society they have there, with one queen and sterile worker bees and ants that are genetically very, very similar to each other.
Well, it's not just the insect world, though. I mean, I've read stories of meerkats, which stand watch for predators while the rest of their pack feed, or vervet monkeys that screech to let others know of predators. thus showing their location to the predators in the process, sacrificing themselves.
Oh, that's so incredibly brave of them. I see. So it does seem like quite common in the animal world, individuals do sacrifice themselves to protect or increase the survival of other members of the group. But how is this noble nature that Darwin talks about passed on to the next generation? Like, it's impossible if they're sacrificing themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that's a very, very good question. Let me tell you a story. So we have to go back to Darwin here. So actually, about 100 years after Darwin came J.B.S. Haldane, who was another stalwart of biology. The story goes that one afternoon, you know, he was several pints in, when somebody asked him, how far would you go to save another person's life? He started, you know, scribbling furiously on the back of a napkin. He started doing some calculations and he said, I would jump into the river to save two brothers, but not one, or eight cousins, but not seven cousins.
I love your impression. Wow, he's a true geneticist.
But actually, if you think about it, he was articulating what underlies your question. Because in nature, animals in the same group are often genetically related. And thus, saving a family member can be just another method of preserving our own DNA.
So the genes underlying altruism get passed on through cousins and nephews and nieces of the altruistic individual.
Exactly. It later fell to the most distinguished Darwinian since Darwin, William Hamilton, to put all this into an equation which we now call the inclusive fitness theory. What we see most commonly in the animal kingdom is most altruistic behavior shows up in kin relationships. So between animals of the same species that are separated by 1 or 2 degrees.
I see. So most animals would probably happily help close relatives more than distant relatives, and distant relatives more than non-relatives.
Bingo.
So essentially, any altruistic action is done to increase the survival of our gene. But in humans, people often help others that are completely unrelated to them. So do animals also do that at all?
I have one other example that might convince you behaving altruistically to genetically unrelated individuals is not purely a human trait. And it's actually a really interesting story described by marine ecologists Robert Pittman and John Durbin. They were observing a pod of killer whales that were attacking and chasing a seal. Now, the seal sought refuge on a floating sheet of ice. Just as the killer whales managed to break up that sheet of ice and dump the seal back into the ocean, 2 massive humpback whales come into the picture. What's strange about this is that usually these two groups of whales are enemies and don't intermingle. Now, the seal swam straight to the humpback whales, and one of them then rolled over onto their back and swept the seal onto its belly and saving it from the killer whales.
Oh my goodness, that's so beautiful.
Apparently, there have been over 70 recorded such episodes of humpback whales intervening in killer whale attacks of unrelated species. So perhaps it's not just a human trait after all.
Okay. This does suggest that a motivation to behave altruistically exists way before we humans started to pondering about morality and virtues. So can we localize altruism to any part of the brain that we then share with other species?
Yeah, great question. And we should look into the physiology. I do want to add, though, that some psychologists think that in humans, altruism has an additional component of establishing, following, and enforcing social norms. Although some would argue that other animals also follow complex social hierarchy and norms, it often isn't as elaborate as humans in our gigantic and interconnected society.
So would you say that altruism does come from evolutionary adaptation, but we have really moved it from a realm of biology into a realm of socialization?
That's a really, really good way to describe it. Let's look at what's happening in our brains when we behave altruistically.
So So, Gaia, tell us, what happens in the brain of altruists?
Okay. So, in studies of extreme altruism, you know, like kidney donors or persons who put themselves in danger to save someone else, altruists often describe their urge to help not as one of careful deliberation, but much more of a sudden impulse. It doesn't come after a deliberate analysis of pros and cons, but more as a bolt of lightning. And that's why scientists who study altruism think that this desire is deeply rooted in a system that humans share with other mammals that operates outside of conscious awareness. And the key hormone in all of this is oxytocin.
Oxytocin, the love hormone.
Yeah. So oxytocin is a key hormone that plays an important role in bonding and strengthening of social ties. In a landmark study in 2005, scientists gave participants oxytocin and then asked them to play a trust game. Essentially, the participant had to play the role of an investor and decide whether to trust and give money to an unrelated individual. When the participants were given oxytocin, they tended to give more money to the unrelated individual. In fact, this behavior was sustained even when they learned that their trust had been breached several times.
Wow, that's crazy. So maybe we should administer oxytocin to our next investor. So irrespective of the outcome, the oxytocin was driving increased cooperativity and tendency to be generous?
Yeah, especially to other humans, so members of your own species. Actually, it really seems to drive pro-social behavior. Just to illustrate the potency of oxytocin in moving us to a more pro-social mindset, a really interesting experiment that was done in 2015 found that giving oxytocin to participants induced a bias. Participants were asked to make a donation to either a social or an ecological charity project. Increased oxytocin seemed to increase donation to social rather than environmental charities, suggesting that it increases our sensitivity specifically to pro-social causes.
That's so interesting that one hormone can switch our behavior to being more pro-social. I'm curious though, so is this because that it's making us feel good? I mean, a lot of good deeds come with this personal satisfaction of having done the right thing and this positive feel-good factor. Is oxytocin involved in that?
Very much so. And you're absolutely right. Because a lot of our motivations to behave in a certain manner, especially outside the realm of conscious thought, is driven by the reward areas of the brain. So the dopaminergic areas that we discussed previously.
Does oxytocin act on the reward area of the brain?
Yep. So oxytocin receptors are found in dopamine-releasing neurons. And oxytocin can drive these neurons. In an interesting study done at the University of Oregon, the experimenter gave out $100 in cash and let the participant decide in a series of questions if they wanted to donate to a food bank. Now, while they were deciding, the scientists watched which areas of the brain were being activated using an fMRI scanner. Some participants were allowed to choose whether to donate or not. Others were not given so much of a choice. And they were just told that their money was going to be donated via a tax. So essentially, voluntold to make donations. The researchers found that the reward, i.e. the dopamine system, gets activated with each donation. They also found that those who chose to donate had a greater activation in the area. But here's the interesting thing. Irrespective of whether the donation was done voluntarily or via a tax, the dopamine system was activated.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is that when someone behaves altruistically, whether the action is active or passive, they automatically, irrespective of how they feel about behaving that way prior to the act, have the reward system in their brain activated. Uh-huh. That is super interesting. I guess that's another way evolution is pushing us to take care of each other.
Absolutely. And we're motivated to repeat this behavior over and over and over.
And I feel like helping others also does make us feel good after.
Yeah. Actually, there have been studies that have shown that altruistic giving reduces blood pressure. It can even predict longevity. It has a lot to do with the interplay between cortisol, the stress hormone, and oxytocin. Oxytocin has long been shown to play a role in reducing cortisol produced by the body in response to different stresses.
I see. So, of course, by being altruistic and flooding your body and brain with oxytocin, you can bring down your level of cortisol and therefore alleviate some of the effects of stress.
Absolutely. As I read somewhere, exercise, eat well, and help others.
Such a good one. So Gaia, you did mention that some psychologists think that in humans, a lot of our altruistic actions are governed by social norms. Sometimes we do help because we want others to think about us favorably, or we think they might be able to help us in the future, etc., etc. Or we think that it's only fair if we help them. So it is reasoned and deliberated. So has anyone looked at that side of altruism and how that plays out in our brains?
Well, I'm glad you bring that up. So the biology of altruism is quite complex. And you're right. When scientists looked at people making decisions to be altruistic, they found that actually the medial prefrontal cortex, which is part of the frontal lobe, is also activated.
So that's part of the brain that deals with reasoning and higher order processing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It appears that the medial prefrontal cortex, or the MPFC, does some pretty important mentalizing. For example, it's involved with processing reputation, like you were talking about, i.e. how we perceive our reputation in the eyes of others. It determines boundaries between self and others. So you were absolutely spot on when you said that altruism has a biological basis, but we humans seem to have moved it to a realm of socialization.
Yeah, because it seems to me that the oxytocin and the dopamine system correspond to our innate altruistic behavior, you know, outside of our conscious awareness, or the prefrontal cortex part corresponds to our more complex socialized response, where we deliberate on our actions.
Exactly. So going back to the question that we had at the start of this section, this complex activity in the brain is why altruism in humans is not just a genetic reflex like it is in some insects and animals, but really a complex decision-making process. If you were to ask me, my feeling is that we've totally become more helpful and altruistic during this pandemic. But I could be biased. Like, it could also be that the media is reporting on these heroic acts and helpful deeds way more than before the pandemic. So Emily, I'm curious, what have you read? Has anyone actually researched this?
Indeed. The scientists have you covered. They're on it.
Whew.
So the researchers in Sweden have recently submitted a paper to Psych Archive.
So still getting peer reviewed right now.
Yes, good point. It's all happening so fast, and we're talking about research that hasn't gone through the peer review yet. What that means is that other scientists have not yet put a stamp of approval on it. So we need to be a little bit more careful about drawing conclusions from this research. So these Swedish researchers surveyed hundreds of Americans online from late March to April, asking people how altruistic and how stressed, anxious, or depressed they have been feeling. So as a population, it seems like people did not become more altruistic as time went on. Their perception of COVID stress also did not change.
Oh, interesting. Although March to April is a really short period of time, and I wonder if they could see more change if they started perhaps in February or even January.
I totally agree with you. It is one of the biggest caveats of this study. By March, the WHO has already classified COVID as a global pandemic, and people's perception of its threat may have already evolved before they started the survey. What is really, really interesting, though, is that they did find that if a person reports a higher anxiety level, he or she also tends to be feeling more altruistic towards others.
Huh. Do you think this is just a correlation governed by other factors, or are they onto something here?
So their results are actually really consistent with what we know about stress and altruism previously. Under stress, traditionally we think of our response to be fight or flight, but in social animals like ourselves, there is this other effect called tend and befriend. Have you heard about this concept?
Oh, that sounds so cute and wholesome.
It does, and it's super catchy. So it is a theoretical framework developed by psychology professor Dr. Shirley Taylor at UCLA. She argues that under stress in a dangerous situation, as much as animals want to fight or flee, many would actually have just as strong a drive to take care of their babies and stay close with others, hence tend and befriend.
Yeah, I guess I could see that making sense evolutionarily.
And we humans are the same. To study this phenomenon in human without actually putting anyone in actual danger, which is really important, psychologists make the participants perform tasks that are safe but highly stressful, like public speaking or solving really hard problems under time constraints.
That would have promptly increased my heart rate for sure.
Same, not fun. So then, after properly stressing you out, the psychologists try to measure how much you're willing to trust or betray or share with others using interactive games. And amazingly, people are way more trusting, honest, and generous when they're stressed. They're way more pro-social.
Whoa, hold up. So I get why there'd be an instinct to protect your children when you're in a stressful situation. But does that extend to total strangers as well?
Yes. So it turns out that when animals are suffering injury or discomfort, that being physically close to others really buffer away their stress. And stress is known to activate oxytocin neurons, resulting in the release of oxytocin, the love hormone that you mentioned before, and lead us to behave in a more prosocial and altruistic manner. And evolutionarily, it might be that when we're in a dangerous situation that makes us stressed, our body is anticipating vulnerability. So it is the time where we really stand a better chance of survival to be near each other and take on the situation together. Our altruistic behaviors under stress are often governed by an ancient compulsion rather than a calculated economic decision, like you said before.
Yeah, like we're doing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like we literally cannot get out of this pandemic without everyone in the world doing their part for the greater good. And nobody is safe until everyone is safe.
Oh, I totally agree. I feel like this pandemic has really highlighted how important it is to take care of our most vulnerable communities. Like if people without medical insurance are too scared to get examined in a hospital, or if people are so afraid of losing their jobs, they just keep going back to work when they're sick. As a society, we won't be able to win against this virus.
That is so true. And it's really sad that it has taken a pandemic for our society to stop willfully ignoring these terrible flaws in our system.
Oof. Speaking of which, why hasn't our society been altruistic enough in tackling these issues?
I mean, that is the million-dollar question. Like, it's a really good question. And I'm really not sure I have a good answer for you. I totally get what you mean, but I feel like there are just so many complex historical, societal, and structural factors in solving these issues beyond just like each individual being altruistic.
But even if we're just looking at it on an individual level, we don't always help, do we? Because sometimes people remain apathetic bystanders. What do you think could be underlying that?
So one thing psychologists has observed is that if the situation is highly uncertain or volatile, and we're fearful or don't know how to help, it would be way less likely that we behave altruistically. Uh-huh. But when we do feel confident about what to do, it's more likely that we would lend a helping hand.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. Honestly, so much respect for the healthcare workers and volunteers on the front line. The amount of risk and sacrifice they're taking is honestly beyond imagination. I am so, so grateful.
So grateful. And honestly, wear a mask, friend. Sure, it's really inconvenient and uncomfortable, but it is such a tiny thing compared to what our frontline workers are doing for us.
Yeah, it's the least we could do. So, Emily, I have a question for you. So you mentioned the two instincts we have under a dangerous situation, to fight or flight and to tend and befriend. These seem like two totally opposite sets of behaviors. How can that be?
Yes. So let me start here. So initially, when tend and befriend is coined as a term in the 2000s, it is used to describe the female response to stress as opposed to fight or flight, which is the male response.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. The news outlets absolutely loved it and started saying tend and befriend is a uniquely female response, which it is absolutely not. Later studies found that it happens in both men and women. Or the media will be making the simplistic statement that males do this, females do that. And people started speculating in their blog posts that this distinction explains why men engage in domestic violence or why women are nice to men who abuse them.
No. Just no.
Just no. I mean, most of these come from really well-meaning places, and I can understand the excitement when you read a piece of science that feels super relatable or resonates with what you already believe in, especially when most original manuscripts are behind a paywall. A member of the public does not have the luxury to read the study in detail and judge for themselves.
Absolutely right. And I guess that's why scientists and science communicators really need to fight the urge to jump to conclusions or oversimplify. I would even say that as people who perform and communicate science, when something confirms what we already believe in, is when we need to be even more careful in order to fight our very human bias in fulfilling our own beliefs or biases.
Yeah, I agree 100%. As Dr. Taylor actually did point out in the 2000 paper herself, her theory should not be used to prescribe social roles or be regarded as deterministic. She was building her theoretical framework based on what is observed in nature. For example, mothers would protect her pups in dangerous situations, but she also reminded us that in some species, for example, the titi monkeys, fathers are responsible for rearing the youngs, and mothers actually actively avoid being left alone with their offsprings.
Oh, wow. See, females are not always by nature more caring.
Yeah, exactly. She also emphasized that in the animal kingdom, female social networks are often not warm and fuzzy at all. Like dominant primate females often harass other females lower in the hierarchy.
Right. We need to be so careful when we propose an evolutionary route for some of our behaviors. It can be really tempting to say, you know, because rodents do it, some primates do it, we also do it. So therefore, there must be some underlying biological mechanism that explains our behavior. But it is almost always so much more complex than that. The pitfall in saying something is evolutionary is to imply that that is the natural way, or we're inflexible, or it is futile to try and change something.
Yeah, exactly. And so much of our behaviors are governed by our social norms rather than nature. And so much of the animals' behaviors are required by the particular environment niche they live in, which is incredibly different from the environment we live in.
Right. How much of women's increased tendency to befriend under stress is because society allows or expects us to, ever since we were little?
Yeah, exactly. And how much of men's increased tendency to fight under stress is because society demands or expects them to, ever since they're little?
Just because a certain trend is observed right now, or in some studies 30 years ago, doesn't mean it's our nature. It doesn't mean it's defined for us.
Yeah, it's not to say there aren't biological differences between biological male and females. There absolutely are. However, we need to ask ourselves, are these differences categorical like our genitalia, or overlapping on a spectrum like height, or only a stereotype that we believe exists but don't actually have an actual biological basis?
Yeah, so true. Because sex is often used as an imperfect proxy for some other underlying variable, such as a certain hormone or certain genes, because it's the convenient thing to do. And as scientists and science communicators, I think we really need to be honest about the actual interpretation of our studies.
Absolutely. Now I want to go back to your original question, which is a really, really good one. So if not sex difference, how does the two instincts, the fight and flight versus the tend and befriend, coexist in one person or in one animal?
Yeah. So how do we decide which of these two behavioral programs to pick when we're in danger?
So a popular framework psychologists use to think about this question is called parochial altruism, which is a tendency for us to tend and befriend those who are like us and exhibit fight or flight response towards those who are unlike us.
Oh, have you heard of terms like in-group love and out-group hate, which I think are related concepts to how we help people who we identify with and are hostile towards people who we don't identify with? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So it is found that oxytocin, the love hormone that we talked about before, promotes conformative cooperation and favoritism towards members of the in-group, people who you identify as more like you. However, it's not all warm and fuzzy. Oxytocin also seems to promote attack, distrust, and non-cooperation of members of a competing out-group.
Wow, a real double-edged sword, isn't it? I guess the real-world group dynamics are definitely way more complicated than what can be captured in the lab. And so many more factors feed into our decision-making right now in a pandemic towards certain groups. But I think we should all want to keep in mind this tendency of ours and to be mindful of maybe that extra frustration or mean-spiritedness we might be feeling towards certain groups of people who we think are quite unlike us.
Yeah, that is very, very well said. The stress of pandemic can tear the divides in our society even wider and have done so in a lot of places. But we are capable of being kind and being altruistic. And that is what it will take for all of us to make it through the pandemic.
Absolutely. I cannot agree with you more. Okay, I think with that, we have come to the end of what we plan to discuss today. Thank you all for listening. And if you like this podcast and want to support us, please give us a good review on the podcast platform you use. That would really, really help other people see it. Also, we're still thinking about themes for our last episode, so let us know what emotions or topics you'd like us to discuss by leaving a review or emailing us.
And of course, share it with all your family and friends and join us on our Facebook page and get connected. We look forward to hearing from you. Please join us next time as we explore the neuroscience of how we remember in the episode, The Remembering Brain. We hope you stay safe, take care of yourself and each other.
Bye.